Welcome back. This is Manuel Criollo, and I'm here with my co-host, Eric Mann. You're listening to Voices from the Frontlines. It's always on at 4 o'clock, so, you know, always keep your memory box on your radio to, you know, listen to us at 4 o'clock. On the phone, we have Frank Broadhead, who has written a piece in ZNet a week ago. It's called Reframing the Iraq Elections. He's also co-author of Demonstration Elections, U.S. Stage Elections in Dominican Republic, Vietnam, and El Salvador. And just a, you know, just a little joke here, I told Frank, well, I'm reading your article, and he says, well, I'm going to have to quiz you as on air to see how much you read this article. So, Frank, we just had a really good conversation with Vijay Prashad, who talked a lot about the conditions inside Iraq itself and the different divisions and different sort of forces that are both fighting against U.S. imperialism and are in support of U.S. imperialism. But I think the crux of your piece was saying, well, a lot of mainstream people who are writing about the elections are saying, well, both this is one main victory for Bush. It's his first, you know, victory in his second semester or second period as president. But more importantly, you're saying, well, you know, most people are saying, well, that means it's going to create sort of benchmarks to leave Iraq. But in fact, you're saying quite the opposite. You're saying, in fact, this will make it more, instead of just short term, this is an almost an inevitable occupation of Iraq.
Well, I think that the fundamental thing to think about in terms of things like this election is to assume that, and I believe it could be argued and proved, but take it from the point of view that the Bush people are planning to stay in Iraq for as long as possible or as long as it takes to establish essentially a client state.
No, and we agree with that.
Okay.
So we're not fooled by the, in other words, we understand this is a long-term occupation. I don't know if you heard the conversation we had with Vijay, but we were saying that obviously, this is Eric Mann, that the one of the ways to stay in Iraq is to create a puppet government that keeps asking you to be in Iraq, since the United States has troops on so many countries all over the world, from Sri Lanka to you know where. And each time they say, well, we're there at the invitation of the government. I think the question is to go beyond critique is, what do you think it's going to take to get the United States out of Iraq? Because we agree with you that it's a long-term mm-hmm. occupation. What are some of the international contradictions, the contradictions within Iraq, and the contradictions in the United States that can get the United States out of Vietnam, get the United States out of Iraq? Because that also has happened.
Well, that's a big order, and I think I'll try to confine myself to things that I know a bit about. I think that there are several fundamental conflicts or issues that the United States has to deal with in order to stay long enough to establish itself at the level that it needs to or wants to. And the election, I think, addresses one of those, which is the crisis of legitimacy at home. And the crisis of legitimacy at home is fueled by a number of things. One is the perception, I think correct perception, that things aren't going very well in Iraq. The second, I think, is that the demands on the armed forces, the number of troops and so on, is getting to the point where the project can no longer be sustained. So I think that the election serves a purpose if it, it serves Bush's purpose if it essentially through the lead and through the media persuades the American people that either things are going in the right direction or that given enough time, the United States will be able to leave.
Well, I mean, one of the things, the United States has a whole history of believing in the occupation of even non-Christian governments or non-Christian people or any kind of non-Europeans. I mean, the whole manifest destiny, the whole fundamental tenet of Christianity is to conquer pagans, heathens, whatever you want to call them, convert them, and if not, kill them. So you have the basis of a very pro-war and very pro-invasion culture that was built, you know, from the 14, 1500s on, from the first, let's say, certainly from the 1600s with the English colonists coming to the United States. So the predisposition of the soldiers to say, hey, look, I was there for weapons of mass destruction, I didn't get that, but I got rid of Saddam Hussein, and then Bush is going to go over and say, look, you're bringing democracy to the Iraqi people. 57% voted. But on the other hand, the deaths are continuing. There will be an armed resistance to this, which will be said that these are the people that just don't believe in elections. There's the overextension right now going on of Iran. There's China making a lot of moves to try to buy up oil companies and pipelines of its own. So there are a lot of forces in the world that don't want the United States to get a beachhead in Iraq. And the two of them, I would say, is one is India and China, and the other is the European Union, which is very worried about what the United States is doing. And the third is a lot of people in Iraq. So that's my strategic sense of the long-term weakness of the United States.
Well, I think all those things are true, and I think, to my mind, especially the overextension is the main weakness. Noam Chomsky wrote something that just appeared on CNET today where he reiterated for about the 12th time or so on that this occupation should have been a snap. It should have been easy. That Iraq was a weak state, and the United States was, you know, is a very strong state, but that they screwed up, and that they screwed up in ways that are almost inconceivable if you were thinking about it prior to the war and prior to the occupation. But then having said that, I don't think that any of the forces that you mentioned there are in much of a position to do the United States to be an obstacle to the United States occupying Iraq as long as the American homeland, the American people, will tolerate or support this mission. Given the lineup in Congress, it would take a very large groundswell in the United States to move the Congress in a serious way so that the Bush people were seriously challenged or seriously constrained. One of the main constraints, I think, would be the draft, and I think that there are all kinds of reasons why the Pentagon and the Bush people don't want to do that. But between the situation now and the establishment or reestablishment of a draft, I think there's a lot of wiggle room. And I think the Bush people hit a home run with the election, and the Democrats are simply not in a position to respond to this seriously because they share the basic view of the Bush people that the occupation is a good idea, and that their only concern is with the tactics and the possibility of leaving sooner rather than later. Thank you.
We're talking to Frank Broadhead, who just wrote a recent piece in ZNet. It's called "It's Reframing the Iraq Elections." This is Manuel Criollo, and I'm here with my host. Co-host Eric Mann. You're listening to 90.7 FM Los Angeles and 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. Well, Frank, I know in your piece you wrote sort of some comparison about these elections to the elections in the 80s in El Salvador, and you know it was quite funny that you know during the election that El Salvador sort of has come out that since the elections El Salvador has come out its name's come out a couple of times, both during the vice presidential debate where Cheney was saying, you know, look at the victory we had in El Salvador, where we brought democracy to El Salvador. I know that in some of Simon Hirsch's pieces that he's been writing lately, he's talking about sort of the U.S. version of democracy and the usage of sort of death squads as sort of new rivals and new sort of tactics that the empire needs to sort of kill off its enemies. Can you go through how do you compare these elections to both the elections in Vietnam and Salvador to these sort of forced elections that Iraq just recently had?
Well, in the piece that you referred to, what I state is that you can consider them all to be demonstration elections in the sense that the goal of the election is only secondarily to elect particular candidates, but that it's primarily to persuade the people in the United States and in Congress that we're bombing and killing and invading and arming and so on at the request of the government, the people that we're bombing and killing and invading. There is a key to make this process work is the mass media, and the mass media does this not through a conspiracy, but through its normal operation and through its patriotic inclinations. And in this case, and in all four cases that we're talking about, the media would, in its reporting, ignore or avoid or put off the agenda the fundamental issues that would determine whether or not an election is fair. And these would include things like the right to campaign, which, of course, didn't exist in Iraq, the right of opposition candidates to run, which simply doesn't exist in Iraq, a free press, which doesn't exist in Iraq. And in particular, it's inconceivable that there could be a free election under conditions of martial law and military occupation by a foreign power. But then, having said that, I think that the election in Iraq is different in significant ways. Here, there is not an incumbent government exactly that the United States is supporting, but rather there are a lot of loose ends up in the air. And here also, the military situation of the United States is much, much weaker or much, much more strongly opposed than it was in El Salvador. So I think that there are some significant differences. But then once again, having said that, the mass media played their role perfectly. Juan Cole in his paper on the election today referred to it as disgusting cheerleading, and he's a pretty conservative or a moderate person. I did a count of Google headlines at 2 o'clock yesterday afternoon, and out of about 190, 175 in their headlines coupled phrases like voters defy and so on with violence and terrorism. And this for the media framed the drama of the election, that the issue became turnout and the contest was between freedom-loving or democracy-seeking Iraqis, which I think is certainly true, and their opposition was not the American occupation, but was these lunatic terrorists and suicide bombers and so on, which obviously is no contest in the American mind. Who could choose suicide bombers over freedom-loving people?
Well, I think the thing we're still trying to say is that there's still a contradiction between the point I was trying to make is that I don't see a short-term ability to get the world's insane superpower out of Iraq. That's
right.
Not what's on the table right now. So, yes, you know, you always have the thing that I've learned from the fall of the Berlin Wall and communism is over. Well, it's not over. It's still being discussed all over the world. The perception in America that whatever you're seeing in front of your face is going to be the long term. So, for instance, in the short run, you're absolutely right. I'm listening today. Well, the Iraqi people who risked their lives for the right to vote, voted anonymously. Some of them, they didn't even have their candidate list out, which makes you wonder who they voted for if the candidate list wasn't. If the candidates were so anonymous, I don't understand what's so good about this election.
That's
but,
right.
But, you know, the point being is that in the short term, given what we know about U.S. politics, Kerry's total disintegration morally and ethically and strategically during the campaign. Now, you have Kennedy. God bless Kennedy. I just said two things, God and Kennedy, in one sentence here. I rarely praise either God or the Democrats. But
slippery slope, Eric.
What?
That's a slippery slope,
I know. So, but Kennedy is saying we have to figure out a plan for withdrawal from Iraq. And it's always Kennedy, not Kerry, who's going to try to position this. Now, I think that for a while, the cycle will go on, that they'll say The majority wants an election. The minority are terrorists, blah, 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 blah. The other thing going on is these, as I keep saying, is that there's going to be continued deaths over there. The cost to the soldiers is tremendous in terms of the American GIs. There is growing, some people know that this is an occupation army, others don't. There's a tremendous deterioration of conditions at home, and my point was not so much that China and India are going to get the United States out of Iraq, or that the EU is going to get the United States out of Iraq. But for instance, on Iran, where the United States is already pushing a very aggressive line, the EU is taking a much stronger position, even than they did on the war in Iraq, to defend the sovereignty of Iran and oppose U.S. military intervention. China is, in my opinion, is just saying, all right, you know, because the Chinese have a very long timeline. And they still are communists, whether they're running a capitalist country or not. They come from a Marxist theory of what's going on. And what they're saying is, look, while the United States is tied up in one very important country, Iraq, we the Chinese, are making inroads in Africa, which the United States is writing off. We're making inroads in Japan, inroads in Korea, inroads in Thailand and Burma and, you know, the entire, in Indonesia, setting up oil pipelines to other independent sources of, not independent, but alternate sources of oil, trying to buy up oil companies. The point is that it's as if the world sees this madman, the United States, clearly threatening to blow up everybody and take over everybody. But the United States has made its main stake in Iraq. For the next 1, 2, and 3 years, 5 years, it's very possible the United States will, quote, win in Iraq, whatever the hell that means. But meanwhile, all its opponents in the capitalist and socialist world are saying, great, the big bully is tied down for a while. And despite its bluster, and despite Condoleezza's bluster, they're not going after Cuba and Iran and, you know, every other country that they're talking about. So there is a way that first being tied down in Iraq is very much in the benefit of people all over the world because it opens up a lot of space. And secondly, the situation in Iraq is not long-term stable, as Vijay Prashad just talked about. It has many internal contradictions that may take, so the United States may both be tied down in Iraq and ultimately lose there as well. What do you think of that?
Well, I think you're absolutely right in terms of being tied down, and I think that if there's a disintegration of elite consensus or at least elite acquiescence, to the Iraq adventure, it will be in part because the United States and the military can't respond to anything else. And whether or not it's true or false, it certainly is simple for the New York Times and so on to, for example, speak of Korea as a more serious problem for the United States. And I think a lot of people would believe that. So I think the being tied down thing is very important, not only in terms of where its military can go, but in terms of what its economic situation is at home. I think the so-called trade deficit and the budget deficit are not really sustainable forever, given the giant amount of U.S. debt held by foreign countries. But in terms of the situation in Iraq, this is so much money and so much control of the world is really right at the fingertips of these neoconservatives. And it's very hard to see them walking away from this. It's a little easier to imagine, say, a Democratic Party regime in 4 years walking away with it from this. But even so, I think that the lure of the control of so much oil and having a kind of a gigantic military presence in the Middle East and Central Asia is very, very seductive for these people. And it won't be lightly abandoned. I mean, it's certainly being hard fought.
Well, I completely agree with you. I mean, what I'm, again, the point I'm making is that I think the United States, given the present balance of forces in the world, it's very difficult to defeat the United States in anything. And secondly, it's very difficult to defeat the Bush administration on anything because we have a very small and weak left in this country that has no electoral either power or sophistication, can't elect a dog catcher, let alone a president. And then we have the capitulation of the at least half of the Democratic Party, as you say, that supports the objectives and has these minor critiques and wants things to go badly in Iraq. They want to get out of Iraq, but only when things go badly. That's their, you know, their only upside. And when things don't go badly, such as a staged election that looked like the Bush administration is exulting over this, I'm saying in the short run, I don't see the united front to get the United States out of Iraq. That's my point. But so then I try to, as a strategist, say, all right, so what is there an upside? Not making it up, if you understand. So one of the things we're saying is that we are trying to build a movement in the United States, an anti-war movement, that really tries to talk about the deterioration of basically the United States becoming a white settler state that tells the blacks and Latinos that we're going to have an ownership society and that you're going to get to own your own Social Security plot someday, which is one of the all-time frauds, you know, that is closing down virtually every social service program. And yet, the anti-war movement is not very strong, and to make another depressing observation, the Bush administration is brilliantly making appeals to the black community, and there's, you know, there is a black woman Secretary of State, and there is a lot of work with this faith-based initiatives to dump money into corrupt black churches who are joining the Republican Party, joining it in a big-time way. So what we have is there's only one, you know, we used to say there's a class struggle in the United States, but only one class is fighting, you know, and the working class ain't doing nothing. Now we have only one party in the United States that's moving like a hot knife through butter, while the other party is not even functioning as a party. And my last hopeful point is Howard Dean is, and Barbara Boxer, give her some props for, you know, but Howard Dean, if he takes over the head of the Democratic Party, I think he is going to try to take on the Democratic Leadership Council and in some way vaguely move the Democratic Party to the left. And that creates at least a little bit of stuff to keep our show having guests every week.
Well, if you want to keep your show going.
That's right. In fact, that's the real reason for this, is to keep our show going.
That's right. It seems to me that just sticking to the election, which is something I've given some thought to, is that the legitimation events that Bush does are so important because although U.S. public opinion is all over the place, the opposition to the war and the support for more or less immediate withdrawal is growing very fast. And if it continues on this track, it will be extremely difficult. So, in a, not exactly the culture wars, but legitimation wars, I think are very important. And if that's true, I think that, at least from my perspective, the most important sort of focus of the anti-war movement might well be put in terms of supporting the dissident GIs, the military families speak out, the vets for peace, and so on. Because in the short term, it seems to me that the critical thing for us to do is to dissolve the public opinion bloc that says support our troops. And if we can turn that around, either through dissent and disruption in the Army or the activities of the families and veterans and so on.
Frank, I have to cut you off again. Frank,